From Michigan Radio, this Canty. Today, the latest from flood-stricken Grand Rapids.
The good part is the rain seemed to stop, so it didn't get to the worst level it could have, but still, it's serious.
Plus, the pros and cons of changing high school graduation requirements.
We're really finding success with the Michigan Merit Curriculum. It's put us on the map as a state in terms of having that rigor.
I do not believe that having students take rigorous career and technical education is a lower bar than a rigorous math course.
And we look at businessman Dan Gilbert's vision for downtown Detroit, helping downtown at the expense of neighborhoods.
You know, I think the one thing that Detroit can't afford to do is to make things about an either-or proposition.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. But first, we look at the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's show, the future of education in Michigan. Governor Snyder has said he believes too much emphasis is being put on four-year degrees in our state. Coming up, we look at the requirements to graduate high school in Michigan. And then billionaire and founder of Quicken Loans, Dan Gilbert, has a vision for reviving downtown Detroit. But what does Gilbert's Opportunity Detroit plan really mean for the city and for its residents and neighborhoods? But first, it has been a challenging few days in terms of rain and flooding through parts of Michigan. In the Lansing area, the Red Cedar River caused flooding on Michigan State University's campus, leaving some athletic fields waterlogged. This weekend, the Lansing Marathon had to be rerouted along the Lansing River Trail because of high water levels. Over to the Saginaw area, where residents there saw flooding from the Saginaw River. Over the weekend, officials opened a middle school in Saginaw Township as a shelter because of flooding in the area. And flooding closed some area roads, and people were encouraged strongly to avoid crossing roadways covered by water. Meanwhile, water levels have lowered in the Midland area, which had been hit by flooding of the Tittabawassee River. And Grand Rapids. Well, Grand Rapids is still coping with the aftermath of heavy flooding that hit downtown hotels, stores, and businesses. Michigan Radio's Lindsay Smith joins us now with an update from Grand Rapids. Hi, Lindsay.
Hey, Cindy.
So what is the flooding situation as we speak now? What are we looking at now that you've gone through a rough weekend?
Yeah, it's been a crazy weekend here. This is a record flood of the Grand River, not just here in Grand Rapids, but in many places. Grand River is the longest river in the state. It goes all the way from Jackson to over to Lake Michigan. So there has been many communities, not just Grand Rapids, that have been hard hit by flooding. To answer your question, where are we at now? Things, you know, you hate to do a big sigh of relief at this point, but it does appear that the worst is over, certainly for Grand Rapids. The water is starting to recede further upstream. Some really hard-hit areas, Comstock Park, Lowell, Ionia, they're starting to see the water go down there as well. So things are definitely getting better.
So over the weekend, Lindsay, how high did the Grand River get? Give us some idea.
Well, got up to a record, I want to say near 22 feet. Now, the flood stage in Grand Rapids is 18 feet, so that's 4 feet above what would be considered flooding by the National Weather Service. It got even higher than that further upstream. So it was up into the basements of certainly many places along the river. And then it's just everywhere that you look, the water is obviously so much higher than you would normally ever see it.
I did see pictures. You were sending pictures, and they were posted at our MichiganRadio.org website. And it really hit me that it was a big hit for the downtown Grand Rapids area. So it made me wonder, who got hit harder, commercial or residential?
So actually, I just got out of there's a press conference that the city held this afternoon. And, you know, they're really saying that the residents in the city of Grand Rapids are actually not doing that bad in compared to other cities. We have flood walls here. The last time that flooding was this bad, we didn't have flood walls. This is like 100 years ago. So in that respect, the flood walls did their job. And in downtown Grand Rapids, at least, the main problem is for commercial businesses that are right along the river's edge. Also, any parks that are right around, there's a few parks right around on the edge that once the river recedes could be really damaged, and we just don't know it yet.
And folks really did pull together, didn't they, to get through the flooding? Some sandbag action?
Yeah, Mayor George Heartwell calls it the most volunteering community in the galaxy or something like that. He's obviously very, very proud of his community. But yeah, we had hundreds of volunteers filling up sandbags, and then Friday people had taken off work even, or some kids out of school, you know, little kids helping fill sandbags. It was people just came from all over to really do whatever they could to help.
100,000 sandbags is a lot of volunteer action.
Yeah, they were doing yesterday on Sunday, they were doing at a rate of 6,000 bags an hour they were filling over there by shovel, by hand.
Now, I know Grand Rapids Mayor Heartwell declared a state of emergency. What did that mean exactly for residents, and is it still holding?
You know, it doesn't mean much for residents. I asked that on Saturday's press conference, and he said, you know, it really doesn't mean much for residents. It really is sort of a technical government thing that they do. It helps sort of notify the state and federal governments for potential funding should a disaster be declared for this flood. It's possible that we could see some state and federal money, but at this point they don't really know if that's going to happen.
Do officials, Lindsay, have any idea how long it's going to take to tidy and clean all this up?
Well, it sort of depends on the weather, but at this point they are expecting the river in Grand Rapids to be back below flood stage by Thursday. So just in a few days it should be, you know, back to normal, with my air quotes here, as far as the water level. Now, cleaning up and stuff, that, yeah, I'd say at this point it's probably too soon to say.
Overall, Lindsay, for people in West Michigan and the Grand Rapids area hit by these higher waters, is there a sense that folks are feeling well taken care of? Do they feel like their local governments did a good job dealing with all of this?
I think that people are, first and foremost, really aware that this is a once-in-a-century type of flood. I mean, the Grand River floods every spring, or at least every other spring, we get some kind of flooding somewhere. But this is really an extraordinary event, and I think for what the governments are dealing with, people have been patient. I have certainly not seen any major frustrations here in Grand Rapids. Upstream, it's been a little rougher for some residents, but I think with social media and the news crews have been out like crazy, so people, I think, have been very much in the loop on things. Communication has probably improved in that way with technology, so people knew what to expect, and I think people just knew to be patient because it was so dramatic. So it's such a big flood.
Such a spring, huh?
Yeah, it has been. I mean, we needed the rain, but geez, spread it out.
Lindsay Smith is Michigan Radio's West Michigan reporter. Lindsay, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And you can find the latest information on the flooding online at michiganradio.org. And while you're there, you can check out the pictures that Lindsay took all through the long, wet weekend. Education is certainly front and center these days in Michigan. Governor Snyder spoke today at his summit of education leaders, calling for businesses to get more closely involved with public education. He believes too many students have been pushed toward getting four-year college degrees when the vocational education track or technical career training or community college might have made more sense. And in the State House and Senate, there's movement towards changing Michigan's high school graduation requirements. Some lawmakers want to change the Michigan Merit Curriculum, the MMC. Then Governor Jennifer Granholm signed the MMC into law in 2006, putting into place some of the toughest high school graduation requirements in the nation. But from the perspective of 2013, critics, like Governor Snyder, say those standards seem to favor students heading to four-year colleges at the expense of those who might want to explore career and vocational training options. Under the bills making their way through the State House and Senate, students would still need 4 years of math, but they could replace Algebra 2 with statistics or technical math. The foreign language requirements would go, and students would be able to use extracurricular activities to replace some phys ed credits. The State Board of Education and the Michigan Association of Secondary School Principals have come out strongly in favor of maintaining the MMC. Supporters of the changes say, no, it's time to allow options for students whose career plans point more towards career or technical ed. So this debate cuts right to the heart of the question, what type of high school education will best serve the students of Michigan and the state of Michigan? Joining me is Wendy Zadeb Roper. She's the executive director of the Michigan Association of Secondary School Principals. She actually joins us from Lansing, where she's attending the Governor's Education Summit. Welcome to Stateside, Wendy.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate the opportunity.
And Jeff Bowl joins us. He's the principal of the Capital Area Career Center. Jeff joins us from Mason. Hello, Jeff.
Hello, Cynthia. Delighted to be here today.
Good to have you both. Wendy, I want to start with you. The Michigan Association of Secondary School Principals has joined with the State Board of Education in calling for the standards to stay just as they are. Why so?
Well, I think that one of the misconceptions is that being college and being career ready are, in our minds, one and the same. And that when we look at what we're preparing students for in the future, we're really preparing students for jobs that may not even exist today. And so we really don't want to limit the options that students have in their future. And we feel that a rigorous curriculum is the best preparation for any field that students may go into in the future. And we just want to make sure that they're as prepared as possible.
And Jeff Bull, you're principal of a Lansing area school that focuses on these career-centered programs and courses. Why do you support altering the MMC?
Well, I support it because I have seen the wonderful things that can come about through career and technical education. I was in industry before I came into education, and I have taught at schools, five different schools, ranging from repeat ninth graders in the urban core of Miami to advanced math and science students at a specialty school in Battle Creek. And the experiences that we provide at the Capital Area Career Center and in career and technical education across the state are truly more transforming for students than any other education that I've personally experienced. It is amazing what you can do when you allow students an opportunity to develop expertise in a particular area. And I argue for flexibility around a few of the academic requirements because when we don't have that flexibility, students are denied the opportunity to access important programs like ours and like other elective programs in the arts or music.
I'm speaking with Jeff Bowl. He's the principal of the Capital Area Career Center, and speaking with Wendy Zadeb Roper, who's the executive director of the Michigan Association of Secondary School Principals, talking about the possible changes in the Michigan Merit Curriculum. We'll continue our conversation after the break and discuss what the future of education should look like in our state and what high school students should be required to take in order to graduate. This is Stateside on Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. We continue our conversation now about what the future of education should be in Michigan. It comes as lawmakers in Lansing debate whether the state should change its high school graduation requirements, also known as the Michigan Merit Curriculum. Jeff Bowl is with us. Jeff's the principal of the Capital Area Career Center. And we're also speaking with Wendy Zadeb Roper. She's the executive director of the Michigan Association of Secondary School Principals. Now, one of the debates around the Michigan Merit Curriculum is whether or not every student should have to take classes in high school that would set them up and prepare them for that four-year degree, or if they should have more flexibility to be able to take more electives and hands-on courses, the kind available at the Capital Area Career Center. So, Wendy, let me ask you this. Are students who want to take shop classes or graphic arts or computer programming or health programs, are they being handcuffed by having to take French or Spanish or Algebra 2?
No, and I think that's also one of the misconceptions that continues to be perpetuated. I fully support students taking CTE-type courses. There's definitely a student population that will be attracted to those types of classes, and certainly there's great employability for students that go through those preparation fields. So in no way do we not want students to go that route. However, in looking at the data that's collected by CEPI, which is the organization which in the Department of Education that tracks numbers of students and course-taking patterns, there's very little decline in students taking CTE classes since the implementation of the Michigan Merit Curriculum. And we had people testify in support of maintaining the rigor, such as Phil Jankowski, the principal at Armada High School, and he brought in two of his career and technical education teachers to advocate for the fact that they've been able to make all of these things work. And what they're doing is embedding the Algebra 2 course right into the CTE program so that students are able to essentially get the standards that they need in the applied setting that they're hoping to take. So we feel that these things can be married and they don't need to be separated. So it's not a matter of picking between career and technical education and the Michigan Merit curriculum. It's finding ways to make those two things work together. And there are a number of schools throughout the state that have been able to make this work.
Well, if I could, I'd like to take exception to a couple things that Wendy said. First of all, the numbers that I've seen, and there may be more numbers, but the numbers that the MASSP and the governor's office have published from CEPI regarding the taking of career and technical education, those numbers are the percentage of students who take career and technical education. And with any statistic, you have to be sure to ask the question whether the statistic actually answers the question at hand. And in this case, that I don't think that percentage does.
Why?
The number that we need to focus on is the percentage of students' schedules that are career and technical education courses. When you consider great music or art training experiences, you need more than one course to become an expert. As with career and tech ed, they need to have more than one course. In some cases, they need to have a series of four courses, freshman, sophomore, junior, and senior year. Or in some cases, they need to give over half a day of their junior and senior year to come to a program like ours at the Career Center. If the question is, has the Michigan Merit curriculum and the Michigan Merit exam reduced elective opportunities for students, there's absolutely no question that it has. And I don't have any numbers on that, I can tell you that if you go into any high school anywhere in Michigan, talk to any counselor or any elective teacher, they will tell you that students cannot access elective courses because they are having to take academic courses they wouldn't have had to take in the past, and in some cases they're having to take them two or three times.
Well, I obviously agree to disagree on that, and I think the data speaks for itself, and I'd personally rather focus on data than anecdotal conversations, because there are just places all over the state that have been able to make this work. And rather than just saying we can't make it work, we don't want to make it work, we need to find a way to find the solution, because it's really in the best interest of our students. I don't think we should be looking at 14 and 15-year-olds and saying, you know, what do you want to do when you grow up, and banking on that without giving them a wide variety of curriculum.
I couldn't
their majors
more
throughout college. You know, it's too limiting at that early of an age.
First of all, I believe that the data argument that I made is valid, and I really believe you need more than one course in any area in order to develop expertise. And another misconception about career and technical education is that it funnels students or it reduces options for them. And I have to be honest and say that when I moved from industry and then into regular education and then moved from regular education into career and tech ed, I really was worried that working at the school was going to involve a little bit of what Wendy suggested, having students make decisions that would limit their future options. I don't see that at all. What the exact opposite happens here, and it happens because what we provide students is an opportunity to develop expertise. They develop marketable expertise in a particular area, and students thrive when they have the opportunity. They absolutely blossom when they have the opportunity to learn how to speak, behave, and be valued by adults as experts. For some students, their experiences here are the first times in their lives where they felt successful in school. And that is truly a life-changing experience when they can go out and present at businesses with our business partners, work with our business partners, and be considered experts in an area. That I know that that might sound like funneling, but what actually happens is students learn to engage their passions. They learn to become self-directed learners. They learn professional responsibility and self-confidence. And those are all portable to any area.
If you're just joining us, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, and we're exploring the pros and cons of proposed changes in the Michigan Merit Curriculum. Speaking today with Wendy Zadeb Roper, she's the Executive Director of the Michigan Association of Secondary School Principals, and Jeff Bohl is the principal of the Capital Area Career Center. Jeff, there is a real clear awareness that America's students are being lapped by students from other countries who are taking foreign languages, they're taking that higher math. So the question is, would changing what are some of the toughest graduation requirements in the country put Michigan's kids at a disadvantage in this world economy?
Well, we absolutely need a certain percentage of university graduates, and we do need some students to pursue high-level academics. There's no question, and we need more of it than we're currently getting. There's absolutely no question, but if the target is 35 or 40%, as a lot of economic studies show, 35 or 40% of our population that we need to have bachelor's degrees in the near future, then I'm not sure what's supposed to happen to the other 60 to 65% who are going to be forced to take a curriculum that's really not designed to benefit them.
And Wendy?
Well, I think what we have to look at is, once again, going back to the trends and the data that we're seeing. And when we look at the graduation rate, which I think is a really important point, a number of people thought that when we put these higher requirements in, there was going to be this huge increase in the dropout rate, et cetera. And what we actually see is that this past year, the graduation rate increased 1%, while dropout rates were down 4.5%. And I think that that's a huge factor that we need to look at as well, is that, you know, students don't rise to a low bar, and that we really want to make sure that all of our students are college and career ready, and those things are one and the same. And this is not a comprehensive high school versus CTE argument. So we just really feel that all of these pieces need to be in place for our students to be successful in the future, whether that takes them directly into the world of work or that takes them onto a college campus.
One of the challenges that I have with something that you, Wendy just said is we don't want students to rise to a low bar. That's an example of some language issues that really, I think, keep us from having a fair-handed conversation about the issues at hand here, because I do not believe, as someone who taught advanced research in AP statistics, I do not believe that having students take rigorous career and technical education is a lower bar than a rigorous math course.
It certainly is not. I
100%
agree with you on
that. That aligns better with their passion.
We can integrate those Algebra 2 concepts right into those very rigorous classes that you're referring to. This is not an argument saying that CTE is a low bar, because it is not.
But you used the word. I'm sorry.
Well, you did use the word low bar, Wendy.
Right. And taking out rigorous requirements, taking out Algebra 2, taking out world language, taking out those types of experiences for kids do lower the bar.
If I could,
let me hear you, Jeff.
The Algebra 2 question, because there has been a big push over the last 5 years to embed academics in career and technical education, and the theory behind that is that a lot of content, a lot of math content, a lot of reading writing content actually does occur in career and technical education courses. So if we can hone the ways that we teach that, we can improve our students' abilities in it, but also career and technical education can take credit for having provided some of that part of the Michigan Merit Curriculum. As someone who had a math-rich career, who taught advanced mathematics, and who now works in career and technical education, I can tell you that the content of Algebra 2 does not occur in the vast majority of careers that are available in the United States right now, and it also doesn't occur in the content of the courses that are taught by career and tech ed schools. So when we use the word embed, it almost sounds like you're just using the Algebra 2 that's there and you're getting it without any cost. But the reality is that it requires removing career and tech ed content from the course to force Algebra 2 content into the course.
Does that make sense to you, Wendy?
Well, the problem is that's Jeff's perspective, and I've met with career and technical education principals who tell me that they're able to make that work. And that, you know, students are actually able to master those really difficult concepts because it is an applied setting.
We do embed advanced academics everywhere where we can, and we actually have used statistics. We have a very rigorous statistics unit that we use across the board rather than Algebra 2, because statistics is more germane to the vast majority of the courses that we teach. When you put Algebra 2 in, it comes at the cost of career and tech ed content. It absolutely does. It's a zero-sum game. There's only so much time in the class period for things that you can teach.
I want to shift gears a little bit here and get you both to comment on the many studies that have shown consistently the states with the highest number of four-year college graduates have the stronger economies. We've seen studies by the nonpartisan Milken Institute, Michigan State University's Institute for Public Policy and Social Research, Georgetown University's Education Center, just to name a few. And they all say those with bachelor's degrees will earn way more than those with some college or a high school diploma. And the states with the highest per capita incomes are those with the highest percentage of college degree earners living in them. And we've already got Michigan 36th in college attainment and 40th in income. So the question to both, shouldn't we be doing all we can to set up Michigan students to get those four-year degrees, both for the good of the students and of the state? Jeff, let me ask you that.
Absolutely. There's no question that we should be doing everything we can to raise the bar for everyone across the board. I think we need to remember that a lot of students, that the economy doesn't need every student to have a four-year degree, and a lot of students are not inclined that way. They're inclined in different areas, and for those students, they deserve a rigorous curriculum that will apply to their futures.
Wendy?
Well, I think I would point to what the business leaders for Michigan is projecting, and they're saying that the economy will demand Michigan produce 900,000 more college graduates by 2025, and that post-secondary degree attainment needs to increase 60% to be able to meet that. So I just don't see why we would change our course of action. We're really finding success with the Michigan Merit Curriculum. It's put us on the map as a state in terms of having that rigor, and it's really caused us to be a leader in terms of, you know, saying that all of our students can do this, and schools are finding a way to make it happen with that increased graduation rate and lower dropout rate, and it just seems to me that we would want to stay this course.
What do both of you want to see in Michigan education standards looking forward? What if you could make it as you know, what you most want to see, what would that look like, Jeff?
First of all, I would back off just slightly on the academic requirements for the exact reasons that people have proposed the legislation, because it does reduce opportunities for students to focus on areas of their passion. Secondly, I really believe that the one-size-fits-all ACT-MME goal is not the right goal. The Economic Policy Institute surveyed recently educators and business people on what they felt the goals of education should be, and only 22% of those goals were academic. So that means that we're testing with the Michigan Merit Exam only about 75% to 80% of what we actually want from education, and I believe we can do better than that. If a teacher were teaching only 75% of their content, we would not consider that best practice. I think that we need to put into play an education requirements and graduation requirements for students that are more focused on their particular interests and goals, and that push them to a level of rigor and expertise that we haven't reached yet for most students. But I believe we could have every student have their own graduation requirements. They could pick, maybe they pick an area or two that they're going to major in, quote unquote, in high school, where they're going to develop some level of expertise, develop a portfolio around that, have some rigorous courses so that they can actually have accomplished something in high school. I really worry that in the model where every student needs to go on to four-year university, that high school becomes the next middle school. It's just the next stepping stone, and we're not trying to get students any final value. And I believe that when we respect career and technical education, when we respect other electives, we can get students a lot of things that are going to carry them forward, regardless of whether they go on to university or not.
And Wendy Zadeb-Rober, your thoughts on what you would like to see going forward in Michigan's education?
Well, when I listened to the business leaders that were present here this morning at the Governor's Education Summit, there was a common theme in that they said that they needed a very well-prepared workforce. And they stressed the fact that students have to be able to work together with people from different cultures and backgrounds, which to me would once again imply that that world language component is important. They also stressed the need for workers who have critical thinking skills and who can think outside the box. And I think, once again, Algebra 2 plays to those strengths. The other thing that I think we need to also kind of bring into this conversation is that Michigan has moving toward the Common Core State Standards. And although there is some, opposition and discussion about that at this point, the other thing that is important is that the Common Core State Standards will be assessed in 14-15, and that math assessment requires more Algebra 2 than the ACT had in years past. So I think that's another really important indicator. But I think what we really want for students is to be, like I said, college and career ready so that they have this vast variety of options in front of them and that they're not limited in any way, shape, or form. And if they choose to go the path of career and technical education, which is a wonderful possibility for them, absolutely, that they also have other options to make sure that if they change their minds in the future, they're not limited in any way, shape, or form.
We've been speaking with Jeff Bull, who's the principal of the Capital Area Career Center. He joined us from Mason today. And Wendy Zadeb Roper, executive director of the Michigan Association of Secondary School Principals, joining us from Lansing, where she's attending the Governor's Educational Summit, both giving us a good idea of the spirited debate about education in Michigan. And we thank you both very much for talking with us today on Stateside.
Thanks, Cynthia. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Coming up next, Detroit native and billionaire Dan Gilbert has a vision for reviving downtown Detroit. But what does Dan Gilbert's plan really mean for the city and its residents? That story comes up next. This is Stateside on Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Dan Gilbert. More and more, we hear and we read about the founder of Quicken Loans, a man with deep, deep pockets, a man who's taking advantage of what he calls Detroit's skyscraper sale, snapping up downtown buildings to the point where today Dan Gilbert owns 3 million square feet of downtown commercial space. His stated goal is to breathe new life into downtown Detroit. A front-page profile in the Sunday New York Times business section calls Dan Gilbert the Motor City Missionary. That got us wondering, just what does Dan Gilbert's Opportunity Detroit plan mean for the city and the people who work and live in Detroit? Joining us is George Galster, who is a professor of urban studies and planning at Wayne State University and the author of Driving Detroit. He joins us from the Wayne State campus. Welcome, George.
Thank you, Cynthia. It's great to be here.
And Toni Griffin is the founder of Urban Planning and Design for the American City. She directed the technical planning team for the Detroit Future City Plan, and she's a professor of architecture at the City College of New York, and she joins us from that New York City campus. Welcome, Toni.
Thank you so much, Cynthia.
Good to have you both with us. George, I want to start with you. You were not only quoted in the New York Times profile of Mr. Gilbert, you hopped into your car with writer David Siegel, and you took him around the city to show him the neighborhoods. Do you agree with his characterization and that big headline of Dan Gilbert as a Motor City missionary?
If by missionary one means that someone has a message to sell to a larger population, then I think the adjective is appropriate. Because, among other things, I think Mr. Gilbert is trying to sell the larger world on the notion that there is opportunity in the city of Detroit, despite the worldwide bad press that it tends to get. And boosterism absolutely is part of the game that has to be played for the city of Detroit, because it does have a tremendous amount of assets that often go unrecognized in the barrage of bad publicity. So I think he indeed is a missionary, and he needs to be.
Toni Griffin, it's very clear Dan Gilbert's vision for reviving Detroit is to get the retail and the restaurants and the businesses and the people into downtown. So outdoor seating and cafes and ground-level retail stores. But that's 2 square miles. Do you think that vision helps or hurts the 137 square miles that remains of Detroit, the neighborhoods?
You know, I think the one thing that Detroit can't afford to do is to make things about an either-or proposition. Detroit, like any other city, needs a strong, healthy, vibrant, mixed-use downtown. Detroit is still the third largest employment center in the region. It has a significant amount of commuters who come into the city every day and a significant amount of Detroiters who are living in the city. Those commuters and workers and visitors, in 2009, I think there were 50 million visitors to Detroit, need access to amenities that support business, culture, and entertainment institutions. So certainly having a more walkable and vibrant downtown is a real asset. It, related to Detroiters, there's a significant amount of spending that's leaving the borders of Detroit for Detroiters' everyday needs. Over $2 million being spent on groceries by the average population of Detroit, and another $1.5 billion on other expenditures related to retail. All these dollars are leaking outside of the city. So I would imagine that Detroiters want more options in town that they can get to, and certainly downtown offers a great opportunity to do that. But doing downtown is not to say or to pit it against should it be downtown or the neighborhoods. It has to be both.
And does that Opportunity Detroit plan really address the needs and the problems of the neighborhoods, in your view?
Well, the needs and problems of the neighborhoods are distinct, just as the needs and issues of downtown. But downtowns, and in this case we're talking about Midtown and downtown, very much supports the economy of the whole city and very much supports the cultural and retail and commercial life of the city, too. And so certainly things that are going to come to fruition through Opportunity Detroit are going to have advantages to Detroiters long term. What we need to think about is how to make more connections that perhaps directly link to neighborhoods and residents. What's wonderful is that part of this plan is promoting entrepreneurship, both in terms of business starts as well as finding spaces for those businesses. To the extent that there can be links to neighborhood businesses or Detroiters who are looking to start businesses, that's a direct household impact in terms of wealth creation. So I think that there could be some really wonderful connections and positive connections that affect Detroit households.
George, what's your view of that?
I'm so glad Tony said that, because it's such an important point, and I cannot agree with her more. Let me even amplify it, if I could, by building on her great point about the connections between the health of Detroit's neighborhoods and the health of its downtown, midtown area. I completely agree that there are important synergisms. So, for example, not only the entrepreneurial connection that Tony just mentioned, but think about it in a couple of other ways. In terms of producing jobs for Detroit neighbors and producing tax base for Detroit neighbors. If, indeed, we are able to create more job opportunities downtown, both directly in the new office jobs that are being created, but more importantly, indirectly, with the new retail and entertainment jobs that are being created, this opens up a wide spectrum of job opportunities for the generic Detroiter, regardless of whether they live in the downtown, midtown area or not. This improves their access to job opportunities at a variety of skill points. Secondly, we know right now that the city of Detroit is having, shall we say, some financial challenges.
Understatement of the year.
So we have to rebuild the tax base of this city if it's going to have any chance of providing a decent quality of life, providing decent public services. And this applies to, of course, the generic Detroit neighborhood as well. Well, tax base that happens to be located downtown benefits any neighborhood, any place in the city, if it helps put more police back on the street, firefighters in the firehouses, and so forth. So to create more economic development downtown is absolutely in the vital interest, the necessary interest of Detroit neighborhoods. As Tony said, it should never, ever be thought of as an either-or. It's a synergistic process. Each benefits the other.
Cynthia, what George and I are talking about is really the human capital connection to neighborhoods in downtown, and to just really sort of put a finer point on that, only 15% of Detroit's private employers are African American in a city that has 82% African American population. So where the rubber can really hit the road are really directed efforts to integrate those populations, those businesses, those entrepreneurs, in addition to creating jobs for Detroiters, building social and economic wealth is very critical to the overall success of the city and its neighborhoods. From a physical standpoint, which I think you're also getting at, one of the things that we need to look at is, you know, perhaps how some of these interventions can actually be replicated in other parts of the city. Through our Detroit Future City Plan, what we recognized and really lifted up is that Detroit is not only a one-company town anymore, it's also not a one-employment center town. When we looked really carefully at the distribution of jobs and employers in the city, we found that there were seven potentially strong employment districts throughout the city, actually in every quadrant of the city, that was linked to really strong growth sectors around industry, eds and meds, creative class, and entrepreneurship, with which some of these strategies that are being deployed in Opportunity Detroit could also be replicated in other parts, like Southwest Detroit around our industrial base there, like Nichols Corridor around the hospital and university in Northwest Detroit. How can Gilbert and his team help to inspire, educate, support other private sector collaboratives, perhaps with institutions, so that this begins to mushroom and have a bigger effect throughout the city?
So you're saying break that ground, get the ball rolling, and then bring more partners in.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's lots to be learned around what the private sector and the institutional sector is doing in downtown and midtown that perhaps could be deployed around the district of the University of Detroit Mercy, for example. There are ways with which to think about business partnerships and business improvement districts that could perhaps be translated to the neighborhoods in and around Southwest and the port area and the intermodal transit area, that we start thinking about industrial business improvement districts as ways with which to build coalitions around those business partners and those business anchors to help support and build and strengthen the communities around those job anchors.
I'm speaking with Toni Griffin, who's the founder of Urban Planning and Design for the American City, and she directed the technical planning team for the Detroit Future City Plan. She's a professor of architecture at City College of New York. And George Galster, who's a professor of urban studies and planning at Wayne State University and the author of Driving Detroit, kind of examining the plan called Opportunity Detroit, put forth by mogul Dan Gilbert, who certainly is making a mark in Detroit. And to both of you, I wanted your thoughts. We certainly saw how a mogul's perhaps well-intentioned vision of redeveloping downtown didn't work so well, and that was the case of Henry Ford II leading the way for the Renaissance Center. Can you spell out the ways for us that that hurt instead of helped downtown Detroit?
I think the Renaissance Center was product of bad timing as much as anything else. It appeared on the scene as fresh Class A office space in the midst of a horrible downturn in the metropolitan Detroit area, especially in the office market sector. And because of not only its status as the latest, greatest office building in the city, but also, I suspect, because of the pressure that Henry Ford II and other major business leaders were placing on folks, they filled the Renaissance Center, but unfortunately, they filled those offices with tenants that vacated other older, less prestigious office buildings in the core. Plus the fact, it really wasn't about entrepreneurship. It, I think, was more about just generic office space and some, in this case, gigantic, outsized new symbol that Detroit was going to come back. Neither of those things ultimately proved effective. So I wouldn't want to take the example of the Rensen and say that it holds much precedent for what we're seeing today.
Well, I guess go ahead, Toni.
I'm sorry. Here's the irony of Rensen. I completely agree with George about its unfortunate timing and its initial development. But my first time spent in Detroit was actually as the associate partner in charge of the repositioning of the Rensen for General Motors when they purchased it from Ford Motor Company in the mid-90s.
Yes.
So I spent a year and a half there running the office of Skidmore, Owings & Merrill, who was working with Heinz. Ironically, Matt Cohen was our client, and Heinz Development. And it was if not for them making a very crucial decision to maintain their corporate headquarters in Southeast Michigan, but specifically to maintain it in the city of Detroit, and then begin to think about the repositioning of that architecture to become more connected to the city. I think the really great success story about that is that from the time we started that project to now, unlike what many cities are unable to do, you have a very successful Riverwalk that is programmed and used and beloved by Detroiters far and wide. And I think it's one of the most successful public spaces in the city because of the very eclectic and diverse programming and populations that utilize that and really celebrate the riverfront as a part of the city and its image. And I think if there is any lesson to be learned from the Renaissance Center, I think it is to think about how Opportunity Detroit, in its development of the downtown, thinks about the public realm from the perspective of the diversity and inclusivity of the city and its residents, as well as visitors and workers, and to ensure that those design strategies and programming are as inclusive as possible and become the best representatives and ambassadors of what Detroit is about.
Do both of you, what do you think of the people that Dan Gilbert has surrounded himself with? Are they the right people as he makes this indelible mark on downtown Detroit?
I don't know who his entire team includes, but I would certainly hope if it doesn't, and as he's building it, as the program and opportunities for Opportunity Detroit build, that it becomes a team that is very inclusive of the diversity of the city, so that what is developed within downtown really becomes a reflection of what the city is about. So that's going to include finding folks that are Detroiters that work in and around Detroit, as well as, and to his credit, you know, finding the best minds and examples of people working all over the country and the world and figuring out what can be learned and perhaps adapted to fit into Detroit's context. But I think at the same time, and most importantly, how to make it authentic Detroit.
George, what are your thoughts?
The key in obviously a very politically fraught environment in which he's operating is to make sure that bridges are built and hands are extended and inclusivity is job number one. And I think that would extend also not only to who he's on his team, but how that team reaches out to various neighborhood constituencies in Detroit and gets the message out there, which is an easy sell, that what they're doing benefits the neighborhoods. It's not at the expense of neighborhoods. So that has to be done, and I suspect his team has a sensitivity to realize that it needs to be done as well.
That point can't be underestimated. If there's anything to learn through our 2.5-year process of Detroit Future City, is the importance of outreach, engagement, and conversation, not one-way dialogues of information sharing, but formats and forms that really allow Detroiters and the users of downtown to be active participants in shaping what the downtown and midtown are to become. And in doing that early on and in doing that in a way that people feel is very authentic and inclusive, will go so far into people feeling like it's their downtown and that they had a hand in shaping it in some way. And I think that that is aided by being very intentional about the composition of your team. We deployed a tactic using what we call process leaders, which were, I guess, change agents and influencers in and around the city working at the scale of community and neighborhood. And they partnered with us in not only thinking and designing what our outreach and engagement should look like, but actually being the folks that went out and facilitated the conversation, that had a knowledge base that we worked with them on to develop so that they were the voices that their constituents were hearing from, talking about the benefits or challenges of what this plan might become. And so there perhaps are ways by which to really get Detroiters more involved and a diversity of Detroiters more involved so that the long-term sustainability of what's created can really be shared by all Detroiters.
Tony Griffin, the founder of Urban Planning and Design for the American City, and George Galster, professor of Urban Studies and Planning at Wayne State University. Pleasure to talk to both of you, and I hope we get to do it again soon.
It would be our pleasure, I'm sure. Thank you, Cynthia.
Thank you so much.
Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today, Mercedes Mejia. Contributors are Allie Billings, Austin Davis, Maya Friedman, Emily Fox, Mercedes Mejia, and April Van Buren. This program's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening.